I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep. One man gets more than 250,000 signatures on a petition to roll back Stand Your Ground laws. He takes his fight to the NRA convention. The feds consider raising the minimum wage. We consider what it takes to live on it. And a rep from the Longshoremen's Union helps us translate a new anti-union law proposed by the right. We're getting to all that this hour on In Deep. It's always so welcome to hear this music toward the end of the week, because it means Laffy Taffy is on the phone. It's Gotta Laugh, our correspondent who looks at the world through her own corkscrew lens. Hey, Buttercup, how are you?
That was awesome. I love corkscrew lens. But listen, you know, I almost didn't even make it here today. After Hillary Rosen's apology, I kept waiting and waiting for Alan West and Mitt Romney to say they were sorry for things that they've said and it never happened. So I, you know, I was held up.
I thought you were going to tell me you were waiting for a bus and everybody was so busy throwing Hillary Rosen underneath it.
Oh, my God. I know the sport. You know, I really don't see much wrong. I know what she was trying to say, and so did everybody else.
Well, in fact, let's back up a bit and tell our listeners what's going on here. This is the woman who's a Democratic. She works with the Democratic Party, and she was making the point that Ann Romney does not have the experience that qualifies her for what Mitt Romney said she could do, which is economic work.
Her quote is, "His wife has never actually worked a day in her life. And had she said his wife had never actually needed a paying job in her life or isn't qualified to do such and such in her life, you know, it would have made sense to the whole wide world and this could have been avoided." But and also, by the way, the Romney camp is still saying that that Hillary is an Obama not staff member, but somebody who works with the Obama camp.
And an operative. She's an operative.
Yes, well, she's not an operative.
Well, they did manage to blow this up into, like, the non-war of the year.
It's a fictitious mommy war. And it, you know, the thing is, who is it that has the choice to stay at home with the kids? It's Ann Romney. She has a choice whether her kids get good health care. She has she was saying, "I know what it's like to suffer. I have a terrible disease." And it's true. She has a terrible disease. She has she had breast cancer, as I recall.
Yes.
And she, I forgot her other ailment, which is a serious one. But she has the ability to pay for her health care. And she has the choice whether she wants to stay home with her kids or go out and work. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Romney, Mr. Out of Touch, not only has his little war on women, but he's got this war on reality. And I want to know where his apology is for not taking a stand on the Lilly Ledbetter Act, not even knowing what it was, I think. What about gay moms who stay at home and they get attacked by people like Willard Romney?
Yes.
What about all that? So meanwhile, there's a 2007 story where Ann Romney was struggling to connect with people because here she is, the wife of a very wealthy man. And she comes out with how she kept up a lifestyle that very few people can relate to because she's into dressage. And dressage is a sport of seven-figure horses and four-figure saddles, I'm quoting from this report. "The monthly boarding costs are more than most people's rent. Asked how many dressage horses she owns," Mrs. Romney laughed. Mitt doesn't even know the answer to that. "I'm not going to tell you."
Oh, my extensive wealth is so amusing.
But now, you compare her to Michelle Obama and how down to earth she is and what she does out there. And she has a choice. And she does good things for people who can't do good things for themselves.
Let's move on to someone else who's completely out of touch. And that would be our good friend, Florida Representative Alan West. What central casting did he come from?
Oh, my God. Honestly, this man, he's the one, by the way, who didn't mind when Nicole Sandler, our friend and radio host, was arrested for having asked a question at his, quote, town hall meeting. Alan West was asked, "What percentage of the American legislature do you think are card-carrying Marxists or international socialists?"
So many of them, declared no less. And it turns out he's talking about the Progressive Caucus.
And he says, yes, he says, "I believe there are about 78 to 81 members of the Democratic Party that are members of the Communist Party." What does that have to do with Marxists or socialists, for one? And for two, huh? And the Communist Party USA answer was, "That's the most ridiculous statement I've ever heard." Now, this sounds like McCarthyism. It sounds like Jan Brewer-esque, "Where are your papers?" type of expression. It sounds like modern-day witch hunt stuff. He's the same guy, by the way, that called Debbie Wasserman Schultz the most vile, unprofessional, and despicable member of the U.S. House of Representatives, and the one who Sarah Palin wants to be a vice presidential nominee. So we can see what he's about.
Oh, good Lord. Let's move on to birth control. That's going to cheer us up.
Too bad there wasn't anyone. Anyway, this is rather amusing. Teen births are now at historic lows, and conservative states are the ones that have the higher rates. The teen birth rate has declined 9% between 2009 and 2010. It's an all-time low. Fewer babies were born to teens in 2010 than any year since the peak of World War II. Why? Because of better sex ed and more widespread contraceptive use. Uh-huh. You know, contraceptive use. And the southern states, by the way, the more conservative states, have higher numbers of teen pregnancies and births than that snobby New England does. And the birth rate is higher in more socially conservative states. Why? Because it's harder to obtain hormonal birth control like the pill and IUDs, which is exactly what the GOP is trying to ban.
And with that, Miss Laffey, we got to bid you adieu. I thank you so much, honey. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much.
And that's our own Gotta Laugh. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. So back on the topic of the NRA, it's a topic that won't go away, and I'm really glad that we have some information to bring to you that might be a little encouraging for a change. We're about to talk to Joe Grace. Joe Grace had worked before with a group called Ceasefire PA, working in the gun control area, gun violence control, and he is now working to do the same thing as a private citizen. Joe Grace is on the ground in St. Louis where NRA is having its convention, and he's been working online to get more people aligned against gun violence. Joe, thank you for taking time for us.
Angie, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me about a topic that is important, I'm sure, to all your listeners, reducing gun violence in this country and doing something about some of the reckless laws that we see out there across our country that make us all unsafe.
Tell me what you hope to accomplish by being, you know, in the jaws of the lion there, down there with the NRA.
Well, I think we came here to St. Louis to deliver a message. We think it's a powerful message. We put a petition up on change.org about two and a half weeks ago that said that we thought that the so-called Stand Your Ground law in Florida, which at that point was very much shielding even an arrest of the alleged killer of Trayvon Martin, was part of a pattern of reckless policies of the so-called Stand Your Ground laws across our country, pushed and promoted by the gun lobby, by the NRA, and that I was personally outraged as a citizen. I had worked on this issue before in Pennsylvania when this we really consider these laws to be more shoot-first laws than stand your ground. It engenders more potential for armed conflict between citizens. It's the last thing we need to make us safer in terms of communities and neighborhoods. Law enforcement is against any expansion of these laws. And I had worked against it in Pennsylvania.
That part's very interesting because your work in Pennsylvania, if I can interrupt you here, I just want to bring our listeners up to speed. Your work in Pennsylvania is really emblematic of what happens with the NRA. You were with Ceasefire PA. The governor, Edward Rendell, was on the side of, you know, trying to keep the gun violence down. The Stand Your Ground law was passed, the expanded Castle Doctrine passed while you were there, but the governor helped to get that vetoed. But the NRA came back after he left office. And this is what we see, is that this fight is never over, because if we defeat it the one time, the NRA is waiting with money and influence to bring it back again.
No, that's right. And we were able to see the law stopped by Governor Rendell. He vetoed it at the end of 2010, I believe. But the gun lobby just came right back the next year with a new governor who was pro-gun, pro-NRA in place. And they passed this Stand Your Ground expansion law in Pennsylvania, and it became the law in Pennsylvania. It doesn't make us any safer. In fact, law enforcement official after law enforcement person, police and prosecutors and chiefs alike will all tell you it just sets up more possibilities for confrontations between citizens, exactly the kind of thing that appears to have happened in Florida with the death of Trayvon Martin. So when that case happened, I was outraged to see that this Stand Your Ground law in Florida was being raised as a potential defense in the case of the accused, George Zimmerman. So I decided to do something about it, and I put a petition, a simple petition, up online at change.org, calling for the repeal of Florida's Stand Your Ground law, urging Americans, citizens, who also believe that these policies are dangerous and reckless and render us more or less safe as a community, to do something about it, to lend their voice to the petition. We didn't know what would happen, but lo and behold, two and a half weeks later, 219,000 Americans have signed this petition from every state in the country. The numbers grow daily. And so we decided to come to St. Louis, and we'll hold a news conference tomorrow with local officials who feel as we do that these Stand Your Ground laws should be abolished from the country. There's one here in Missouri, by the way, Angie, and that's another good reason to be here, along with the fact that the NRA is holding its annual convention here this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, one of the questions I have for you, I was listening to NPR this morning, Talk of the Nation, and our listeners know that we record this on Thursday, so they're hearing this on the weekend. And to be fair, I didn't hear every minute, but of the 40 minutes they were devoting to the Trayvon Martin shooting and the Stand Your Ground law, I did not hear them mention something our listeners are very well acquainted with, we've talked about it endlessly, is the connection between the Stand Your Ground laws, the NRA, and ALEC, the legislative arm that works in the shadows to get this kind of legislation passed. And they've got the Stand Your Ground law going in at least 13 states right now. It gave me pause to wonder about our technique. And when I say our, I mean the people who are against gun violence, who feel there are too many guns and they're too easy to get. When we talk about the connection to the NRA, when we talk about the connection to ALEC, are we dealing in backroom politics that people on the outside of this little bubble really don't care about? Would we be better advised to say, guns kill people, there are too many guns, politics aside, let's get rid of these guns? Talk to me about approaches here.
Well, I think those are very good points that you're making. I think there's a couple of answers there, Angie. I think that the backroom politics matter. I think that when a organization that's funded by large corporate interests that don't work to the benefit of the average American person, the average American citizen or taxpayer, particularly on issues like this, on issues of gun violence prevention, when an organization like ALEC is drafting these Stand Your Ground laws that are then being pushed and promoted in state legislatures across the country, I think that's a connection that the American people need to know about. I think that that's something happening in the back room that they have every right to know about. I think it's also true that they can take a more direct form of action and lend their voice to things like the petition at change.org calling for a repeal of Florida's Stand Your Ground law. We're building something that we think has real potential here. Again, 2 weeks, a little less than 3 weeks, nearly 220,000 Americans to sign a petition. Those are very large numbers. The number continues to grow every day. So that particular petition has struck a chord. We want to promote and encourage as many Americans who are like-minded as we are to sign that petition. And so we can see collectively more and more American voices, grassroots power at its best, to then take this argument not only to the Florida legislature, which is the purpose of this petition, but to take it to any legislature that has put one of these Stand Your Ground laws in effect. They don't make us more safe. They render our communities and our neighborhoods more dangerous. And these Stand Your Ground laws, which we call shoot first laws, they should be abolished from our country.
In fact, yeah, I wanted to talk about the phraseology there. Let me remind our listeners that you are listening to In Deep Radio. I'm Angie Cuero, and we're talking to Joe Grace. He's the power behind a website that we're putting a link to on our site. We're at indeepradio.com. His change.org petition with 215,000 signatures right now, 215,000 plus, is repeal Florida's reckless shoot first law that shields Trayvon's killer. That link is on our website at indeepradio.com. Joe, talk to me about the importance of how one phrases this, because if you say stand your ground, it sounds so defensible, it sounds so rational. And when you say shoot first, it gives it a whole different Wild West turn.
The best way I can describe this is to tell you a story. In Pennsylvania, when I testified against, in Pennsylvania, there is another way to look at these so-called stand your ground laws. It's an expansion of the old castle doctrine. A man or a woman's home is their castle, and you have a right to defend it. That concept has been around for hundreds of years and dates to well-settled British law brought to our country. What these expanded laws do, expanded castle doctrine, stand your ground, is they expand the zone in which people have no duty to retreat safely from a potential confrontation, including an armed weapon or a firearm, so that it's no longer that you have the right to defend your home. Now you could potentially shoot first if there was a confrontation on the sidewalk or near or in your vehicle.
It expands
the zone in which these kind of confrontations can happen. And the result, which we've clearly seen in the data that is available, Angie, is an increase in these so-called justifiable homicides, meaning a confrontation happened, but a death ensued involving a gun, but someone was not charged because these stand your ground laws were invoked as a defense, where previously it would not have been a defense. These laws are a defense attorney's dream, and they are law-abiding citizens' nightmares.
Well, I'm trying to understand what the NRA gets out of a stand your ground law. What do they gain from having that passed?
I think it promotes the myth that the more guns and more firearms we have on our streets in our country make us safer. And we think that that is a myth. 34 people in our country are shot and killed every day with firearms. Another 50 are wounded. Nearly 30,000 people a year are shot and killed with firearms. That includes both homicide, suicide, which no one ever likes to talk about, and also accidental shooting deaths. This proliferation of a culture of violence and a culture of everyone should have a gun is not making us safer. It's making us less safe. And that's why we want to try to draw a line in the sand in the aftermath of the terrible tragedy in Sanford, Florida, and stand up and say we're standing up against Stand Your Ground, and we're asking Americans to join us and sign that petition. And we will take that petition first to Florida, and then we will take it to other legislatures as well.
I would just want to share with our listeners, we're coming down to the end of this interview, but I just want to share with listeners one of the comments on the site. This is Marion, who signed the petition and said, I signed this because my daughter's fiance was murdered in Florida by a man shielded behind this law. I'm so angry in this day and age. People are allowed to shoot first and ask questions later. And with that, Joe Grace, I want to thank you for the incredible, incredible work you're doing. We've got a link to your change.org petition up on our website. I wish you the best, and I want you to check back in with us, okay?
Angie, I'd love to, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and to speak with your listeners.
And that petition can use your signature. You don't have to be a citizen of Florida to sign that, because it is going to go well beyond Florida. That's at change.org. Check out our website, too, indeepradio.com. I'm Angie Cuero. Stick around for more here on In Deep.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust. I
need a fix, 'cause I'm going down, down to the bits that I left uptown. I need a fix, 'cause I'm going down. Mother Superior jumped the gun. 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 Mother Superior jumped the gun.
This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. We're talking about the minimum wage. The federal government, of course, says you can only pay people so little to work. And unfortunately, in many cases, people pay only as little as they have to. The federal minimum wage does not determine the minimum wage across the country, though. There are cities and states who have passed their own regulation. And as long as they meet that federal bar, they can put as much over that as they have. For example, San Francisco pays more than the federal minimum wage. They established that through their city council because it makes more sense in such an expensive place to live. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa is proposing a raise to the minimum wage, and while that's pending, we're taking a look at exactly where the minimum wage gets you in America. In a little while, we'll be looking at how that applies to health care, but right now we're talking about housing. How many hours do you actually have to work at the minimum wage to put a roof over your head? No one better to answer that than Sheila Crowley, who's president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Sheila, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be with you.
I think the report that is out, and we're going to link to that at our website at indeepradio.com, it's very striking to see it put out in various shades of blue. You have a couple different graphics of the United States broken down by state. And in one, for example, a two-bedroom housing wage, the hourly wage a household has to earn working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, in order to afford a fair market rent for a two-bedroom unit at 30% of income. And some of these are really, really striking. For example, in California, you'd have to get a $26 hourly wage to get a two-bedroom house at fair market rent. Of course, it's nowhere near that.
That's right. That's right. And actually, if you break it down by jurisdiction, that is the average for California. In San Francisco, the housing wage is $36.63 an hour. So it, and San Francisco is actually the most expensive jurisdiction in the country. And California is the second most expensive state in the country. But we calculate this measure every year that helps people see what the fair market rent is in their community. You can go on our website and plug in your zip code, and it will tell you what it is that you need to be making in order to afford that. And if you go on our website, it's not just a two-bedroom, it's a studio apartment, a one-bedroom, and a three-bedroom. And what we find is that there is a significant gap between what people earn and what rental housing costs. And that is particularly difficult for people at the low end. When we put out our report, we use the minimum wage as a way to illustrate what it means. The minimum wage on a federal basis is $7.25 an hour. It did go up a few years ago. It was very static at $5.15 an hour for a long time. But it's gone up to $7.25, and as you noted, some places have added additional money to that wage. But we calculate how many hours you have to work a week if, in fact, you're only earning the minimum wage to be able to afford the housing wage for your jurisdiction or your state. And so the state chart is illustrative of what the difficulties are. And so in some places, like in California, the somebody who is working at the California minimum wage would have to work 130 hours a week in order to be able to do that.
And the numbers fluctuate all over the country, and you use the different colors on the graph to illustrate that. But I think what I really want to make sure people take away from this is what you noted on that very graph that you're talking about now. In no state can a minimum wage worker afford a two-bedroom unit at fair market rent working a standard 40-hour week. So if you want to get your basic two-bedroom rental, we're not talking about buying a house, we're talking about renting a two-bedroom unit.
Yeah, and we use the two-bedroom as an illustrative thing for this map, but it's the same thing for a one-bedroom. I mean, the minimum wage is not sufficient to be able to subsist in any place in the country. And the people who object to the minimum wage will say, well, that's not what it's intended to do. It's supposed to be a teenage wage or things like that. But, you know, the reality is that a lot of people work at that wage or something slightly better than that. But it still isn't, even if you went to $8 or $9 an hour, you still can't afford housing.
Mm-hmm.
The housing is substantially more expensive than what it is that people in the low-wage workforce are earning.
You know, I'm going to get on my soapbox just a little bit here, because I just get so angry when I hear, for example, the argument that this is about making sure that teenagers make a basic minimum wage. If there's one thing we've learned, it's hard enough to get a job right now, let alone a job with minimum wage, and people are taking whatever work they can get. And by denying them a decent living wage, all we're going to do is end up having to subsidize their lives some other way. There are food stamp programs, there are welfare programs, or, you know, God forbid, these people are living on the street instead, or living too many to one unit. Society pays one way or the other.
And one of the things that we know about periods of the recession that we're in now, or the Great Recession that we've been in, and the unemployment that continues to be at a very high rate, is that that those are people who are unemployed, but there are lots of people who are underemployed. That is, that they are working, they don't have full-time work. And so this, of course, as you noted, depends upon full-time work. And if you've got a job and your hours are cut, or it's a job where you don't have sick leave and your kid gets sick and you need to take the day off, and you're not going to get paid for that time, then all of that contributes to you bringing home even less money. And so the consequences of that are that housing is something that is pretty unstable for a lot of people. They live in there's very high rates of residential mobility amongst low-income people, low-income workers. They, they try to live in one place and they can't afford it, and then they try to get someplace else, and they have periods where they double up with a family member. They have periods where they're sleeping in the car. People can't manage when there is such a gap, and the consequences of it are quite severe for their ability just to manage the rest of their lives. And, kids don't do well in school. People can't. If your housing is unstable and you're not being able to continue to live in one place that you can afford, then that starts to jeopardize your ability to get to work. So it's a downward spiral. So
really, it's one domino after another.
That's right.
Sheila Crowley is president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. And I want to underline something you alluded to there, Sheila, and that was that there are many cases where the minimum wage is kind of a misnomer. We actually interviewed someone who had done a book to study the American way of eating, and she actually worked in the fields. And despite the fact that we have a minimum wage on the books, it doesn't mean everyone's getting it. In some of these cases, you put in for fewer hours than you actually work, or they mess with the numbers so that you get paid by the basket instead of the hour. And occasionally we're talking about people who make $2 or $3 an hour on a good day. And I think it's important to note that goes on, too, in America, even with a minimum wage on the books.
Absolutely. There's a whole underground economy that exploits people who are desperate, and where they are, they certainly can't complain especially if there's folks who are undocumented, and they can get, you know, they can get paid whatever the going rate is, and people are pretty desperate. So the minimum wage applies to those jobs that are, you know, in the sunshine, and nonetheless, there's still a lot of manipulation of it.
One of the things that you work on at the coalition is outreach and education. And, of course, the study we're talking about now is part of that. You're letting people know how this goes on. But inside outreach and education, how do you make people care?
Oh, if I knew the answer to that question, I would be able to, I really would be able to solve this problem, wouldn't I?
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't believe that the vast majority of Americans don't care. I think that one of the issues around housing, though, is that most people are stably housed. Even though we have a foreclosure crisis, nonetheless, the vast majority of the people in the United States have stable housing, and the vast majority of people in the United States have enough to eat. So it's a smaller portion of the population that doesn't necessarily people who are doing okay don't necessarily come into contact with. They probably have they feel badly for people who are struggling, but it's not something that they have to address in their day-to-day lives. It's important to recognize that, you know, the market doesn't solve all problems, that we have a housing system in the United States where the market has failed, and that's where we require the public intervention.
Sheila Crowley with the NLIHC, and we're going to put a link to their website up on our website at indeepradio.com. Sheila mentioned foreclosure there, by the way. You'll find information on their site. If you're a renter and the owner of your house is facing foreclosure, there are specific rights that entail to you, so check that out. And again, we'll put that link on our website, indeepradio.org. Sheila Crowley, thank you so much, and in a moment, we're going to move on to a conversation about health care under the minimum wage. Stick around for that. I'm Angie Cordova. This is In Deep. In Deep Radio is a production of Talkback Media. We are supported in part by our listeners. Talkback Media produces discussions on key political, social, and cultural issues available for live, digital, audio, and video venues. Learn more online at indeepradio.com. And if you are in a position to help us keep on the air, click one of the PayPal links on the side of the page. One-time gifts or a small monthly donation, whatever works for you. We appreciate it. Thanks. And from housing to health, how much does it cost to get birth control? We certainly heard from the Republicans once this became a hot issue that women can get access to birth control. They can go to Target and get birth control. There's no reason that an employer's insurance plan should need to cover this. Well, since we're on the topic of the minimum wage today, an article caught my eye in Good Magazine, good.is, and we're going to put a link to the articles on our website at indeepradio.com. And this is where I uncovered the work of Nona Willis Aronowitz, and it turns out that she is, in fact, associate editor of Good Magazine. And welcome to the show, Nona.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it turns out that on minimum wage, it can still be quite a deal trying to get birth control. And one of the people that your magazine talked to cited as much as $26 a month. And, you know, since we just talked to Sheila Crowley, we know how hard it is to make that much money under minimum wage go just to get a roof over your head. How does this vary so widely that some people can go to Target and get an extra free birth control and the other women say, well, this is going to cost me $26 a month?
Well, it all depends on the kind of birth control that you have. If you have pills, and if it happens to be that same brand that Target happens to carry, then yes, maybe you can get it for $9, and it also might be different in different states. But if your body reacts differently to certain kinds of pills, if you don't react well to hormones at all and are using some other form of birth control, like condoms can be expensive as well, then, you know, you're kind of out of luck. And that $9 figure got got, you know, catapulted into the media world, and people just, at least conservatives, took that as a given, when in reality $26 or even more can be a burden on women who make minimum wage or are in low wage jobs.
You know, what you're pointing out underlines something that I noticed throughout the whole debate on birth control, and in fact the whole debate on healthcare to a certain extent, is an effort to oversimplify what's naturally a complicated subject. And even if you, setting aside the very deep and gnarly subject of healthcare, if you reduce it to just the birth control, there's not a birth control pill. I mean, there are many there are many different brands. There are different concentrations of different hormones. And I think that when we were listening to the Republicans' dialogue about this, we heard at least one who thought you took a pill every time you had sex. We heard another one who would rather you held it between your knees. I mean, there's really basic misunderstandings about birth control pills and how they work.
Right. I think the underlying message here was that men shouldn't have to talk about this nitty-gritty stuff, that women should just take care of it on their own and leave them alone about it. And I think that really came out when Rush Limbaugh, for instance, who's never had a child, so I'm sure the many wives that he's had have used birth control. It's clear that he has never had to have a conversation about that birth control, and they try, you know, men like Rush Limbaugh, who feel icky about talking about vaginas and talking about fallopian tubes, don't really want to talk about it. So during this whole debate, it became clear that the details were pretty fuzzy for men who didn't care to be involved in their women's reproductive lives.
You know, another thing that you bring up in your article, and I'm glad you pointed it out, is the choices that people are forced to make. Since our topic this hour is, or this portion of the hour is minimum wage, and we just talked to Sheila Crowley about people having to make choices between paying their rent or eating. You know, that same thing came up with the women that Good Magazine talked to, and they all chimed in on their own, and some of them said, we may have to make a choice about whether to take my birth control this month or to feed the kids. But it comes down to that reality for them.
Right. Well, just to be clear, the minimum wage article that I wrote was based on a Guttmacher paper. And earlier we had talked to more privileged women. And by privileged, I mean, you know, middle class. Some of them are employed. Not all of them have health insurance. But yes, it's true. Even if you aren't on minimum wage, you sometimes do have to make these choices between birth control and groceries, or birth control on your electricity bill, if you're a struggling freelancer, if you're an unemployed, you know, debt-ridden student. These are the kind of choices that you have to make.
I'm glad you pointed out there are three distinct elements to what you're reporting on here. You had the two separate articles that you wrote, and then the Guttmacher study that you linked to as well, and I think they're all important parts of the picture overall. Do you feel like since this debate about birth control reached such a fever pitch, then it calmed down a little bit? Do you get the feeling that the real information has penetrated at all?
Well, yes, the numbers show that in fact it has penetrated. I think another article that I wrote actually doubled down on these actual numbers of women who are fleeing the Republican Party. Often when you're in these media circles, or even in feminist circles where we talk about reproductive rights all the time, it may seem like this really momentous conversation that everybody's having, and then when you go into the larger stratosphere, it's not really happening. In this case, it actually was happening. Women were actually picking up these messages, and when pollers and one pollsters and people, you know, asking them whether or not this was affecting their vote, they said yes, that they had been paying attention.
This has been great information, and we're linking to all three of those articles, and in fact to your page too, Nona, where a number of your other articles are listed as well. I thank you for taking time to explain this all.
Thanks for having me.
Nona Willis-Aronowitz is with Good Magazine, and we have a number of her articles that she's discussed and the Guttmacher study all linked at indeepradio.com. We're going to switch up topics for our next segment. Stick around. I'm Angie Coiro.
In me. tactics of pickups, right down to the pitfalls and hiccups. Before you start to say stop, it's a stick up. Used to be a my guy that gets the goo, but if we were the lost two people in the world, a human accident, let's take shot before I get it on, honey. Used to be a my guy that gets the goo, but if we were the lost two people in the world, Mr. Mister, why haven't you gone? God's gift to women and God got it wrong. And hiccups before you start to say stop, it's a stick up. Used to be a my guy that gets the goo, but if we were the last two people in the world, a human recipe, sex fiction. Before I get it on, honey, used to be a my guy that gets the goo.
This is Indeep. I'm Angie Kerr. We always do like to stay on top of union developments. We are a very pro union show. We understand the power of employees all together, as opposed to each employee trying to deal with an employer or corporation by his or herself. And so we're very interested. When I say me, I mean me and Engineer Matt and the rest of the crew. And we all got the same email this morning from Center for Union Facts. Certainly seems to be a fact-based organization. And we have this from Rick Berman, executive director of the Center for Union Facts. Turns out he is available to speak about the Employee Rights Act. We were not familiar. The bill was introduced by Senator Orrin Hatch and Representative Tim Scott, both Republicans, empowering employees and guaranteeing workers a private, informed, uncoerced vote on unionizing. One of two things was going on here. Either the Republicans had a complete turnabout in how they view a union workplace, or there was a little bit of doublespeak going on in this conversation. So I thought that rather than try to speak to them directly, we'd go for a skilled translator. So we are bringing on Craig Merrilies. He's communications director with the ILWU. Craig, thank you for taking time out to add your services here.
Great to be here. I'll do my best to make sense out of something that may be nonsensical.
Well, in fact, you know, we were doing a show on union representation not too many weeks ago. Matt was looking up some basic information. And when you go to Google and you enter union facts or union workplace, Center for Union Facts comes up first. And with a name like that, okay, here, you've got the goods. This will tell me all about unions. That's not really what they're there for.
Well, it's just one problem. This is a group like many that pretend to be something they're not. This group is funded by big business and wealthy right-wing forces, and they want workers to stay weak and divided. So they come up with funny names like Center for Workers' Rights and the Employee Rights Act, when in fact these things are all divided to keep, they're all invented to keep people divided, weak, and as poor as possible.
Well, it looks like the way they're trying to deal that out this time around, and this is the pointer from their email, it points over to the Employee Rights Act. And when you pull that up, what Senators Orrin Hatch and Representative Tim Scott are trying to achieve is to throw the workplace back into a supervised union vote every 3 years.
Well, I think what they want to do is make it as hard as possible for workers to have unions, for workers to come together, to speak with one voice. I just don't think anybody in this day and age, with the corporations as powerful as they are, seriously thinks that any one individual worker can take on a powerful corporation and negotiate with any amount of fairness. So the idea of workers coming together, speaking with one voice, forming a union, forming an association, having some way to deal with some fairness, some rules, some regulations that keep the game fair is what we need. And of course, these folks are trying to make it more difficult for workers to join unions, more difficult to speak out without being fired. Right now, if workers want to join unions, they literally risk their jobs. And in many cases, over 50% of cases, workers are fired for trying to join a union. And that's the workers are aware of that those odds. And most of them say, you know, I don't like things the way they are, but I can't afford to lose my job. And so they suffer on, and Orrin Hatch and his buddies want to continue that kind of status quo, which is really repugnant in a democracy.
What's really interesting is the way they posit this, and I'm going to read a little bit from the background memo provided by, you know, via the email that we got from this very helpful Center for Union Facts. The background of this they provide is union membership hit its peak in 1954 when nearly 30% of the workforce was unionized. Since then, labor union membership has seen a precipitous drop to today's record low of 11%. Because union decertification is so difficult, a company unionized in the 40s, 50s, or 60s is most assuredly still unionized today. That is, assuming the union's drain on competitiveness has not put it out of business. The interesting story behind the story here is how hard the Republican Party and conservatives have worked to disembowel unions, to disempower them.
That's right. I mean, we have to be fair here. It's not just Republicans. There are plenty of Democrats that have been doing the bidding of big business. And this is not a strictly partisan issue. It's really a question of political power, of economic power. And as businesses and corporations have gotten bigger and more powerful and have taken more and more control of the government and left the average citizen and workers with fewer and fewer advocates, they have rigged the system, passed laws, and been able to weaken unions so that it's a terrible struggle right now. Workers don't really have a right to join a union.
Craig Merrilies is with the ILWU as communications director. And Craig, I'm glad you caught me on that, because I do tend to do that kind of bifurcating. Republicans bad, Dems do. And we know that's not true. We know that's not true. It's a matter of where your money and your influence lie. Let's take a little bit of a further look into what they're talking about here. And this goes into the right to secret ballot elections. And this would require that employees be given the right to have a federally supervised secret ballot election when deciding whether or not to join a union. And they justify this by saying, according to data from the NLRB, 38% of all union recognitions in 2009, unions bypassed secret ballot elections and instead used card checks to unionize employees. Now, there is the gist of it. Card check is something that's been fought back and forth between pro and anti-union for some time. Give me the guts of the card check issue.
Well, this all boils down to whether it's going to be easier or harder for workers to join a union. In most countries, at least any countries any of us would want to live in, it's relatively easy for workers to join a union, certainly much easier than the United States, which is probably the most difficult industrial country in the world for workers to have a union. The reason why is that although there are some laws on the books that appear to make it possible to join a union, and holding an election and casting a vote for the union or not for the union is one way that it would appear to be fair. But in fact, the system is so rigged right now that it's virtually impossible for workers to win. And here's why. In over half of the cases when workers try to join a union, the companies deliberately fire someone and scare the bejesus out of the rest of the workers, with the clear implication that if you vote for the union, you will be fired, you will lose your job. Companies are allowed to threaten and get away with telling workers that if you vote for the union, we're going to close your plant down and move. If you vote for the union, we're going to cut your wages. If you vote for the union, and they have a long list of other, you know, terrifying scenarios that they spin out, this is perfectly legal, and it's perfectly legal to lock workers in a room on company time and force them to listen to company propaganda while not even providing an opportunity for the union to enter the workplace and speak with workers. They're literally banned from the workplace. So right now, the rules are such, and they've been written by people that hate unions, to make it virtually impossible. So the card check process, allowing workers to literally sign a card saying, I want to join the union, please, would be a very easy way for workers to express their interest in joining a union. Instead, the companies favor a much longer, a more arduous, and one a process that they have rigged that makes it virtually impossible for workers to join the union. So the card check process, making it easier, is something that big business hates and is dedicated to making sure that it never sees the light of day. It can happen now on a voluntary basis, but I can assure you there are very few employers who are interested in voluntarily recognizing a union.
Well, let me ask you this, though. Engineer Matt came up with a really good question, though, is if there's so much at stake, if the workers have so much to be afraid of, and in my personal experience, yes, workers have a lot to be afraid of in this process, then wouldn't a card check be more public than a secret ballot? Wouldn't a secret ballot make it easier to stay anonymous in your support of the union?
Well, the problem is the secret ballot process comes with a whole set of rules and regulations that draw out the process. The time is always on the side of the employer because the employer is dedicated to terrorizing workers. They have every advantage. They have the ability to lock workers in a room and force them to listen to propaganda. And if workers get up and try and leave, they're fired. And that's legal right now in this country. It's also legal to ban, prohibit, and bar any union representative from coming onto the property and meeting with workers and explaining to them the benefits of joining the union. That is currently prohibited right now. It's possible for employers to extend the length of the election for so long, often delays of months, sometimes years, before the election ever takes place, such that the dream, the hope of workers having a union begins to diminish. The employer pounds away with these mandatory locked room sessions where workers are fired if they don't attend. And when it's all over, very few workers are able to stand up to that kind of thuggy, abusive, form of terror waged against workers. And it's all perfectly legal, and it's done under the claim that this is part of an election process. But the rules look nothing like the kinds of elections that happen at the local, state, and national level. They're all rigged to favor the employer in ways that none of us would tolerate in our own democratic votes for city council, Congress members, and even the president.
You know, it's funny that you should bring up some of the tactics they use, because in the press release, of course, it's the unions who are downright evil. Unions pressure tactics run from paid picketers to political fights to brand attacks. Union front groups are common. Unions overall modus operandi, and they left out an apostrophe here, which always gets me. Unions overall modus operandi is to blackmail a business by escalating pressure tactics until it capitulates to the card check. The process is unregulated. Anecdotal evidence, always reliable, suggests that signed agreement cards are often obtained through deception, coercion, and intimidation of employees. You nasty unions, you, Craig.
Well, of course, there are plenty of studies that say exactly the opposite. But, you know, this boils down to a fundamental question of whether Americans think that working people have too much or not enough power in our society today. And the polls all show that by a large margin, they feel that working people don't have a voice. They don't have enough power in the society. Polls also show that most Americans feel that big business has too much power and too much control. Now, the interesting thing is that they also are concerned about unions, and unions have been so scapegoated and so persecuted that although they now represent a tiny percentage of the workforce, they still are a convenient boogeyman to be attacked by big business, and those attacks work, and the attacks continue because they have vilified labor unions. But I think more and more people are recognizing that if labor unions get any smaller than they already are, that it will hurt the entire society because there won't be anybody to stand up for better wages, including better minimum wages and laws that prevent discrimination. And even our Medicare and our Social Security system, these were passed with strong support from workers that organized to get those reforms for everyone. And right now they're in jeopardy. They're the same forces that oppose unions want to destroy Social Security and Medicare. So this is, again, a David and Goliath contest between the power of big business, big capital, and corporations versus the little guys, the folks that make the country run, that the working people of this country that are being sold down the river by politicians and by their financiers in Washington and Wall Street.
We're running short of time, so I'm going to have to cram the last two points of their little project here together. One is the decertification coercion prevention. And they say this is necessary because data from the NLRB indicates just one in four decertification attempts are successful. Okay, there's a grammar error there, too. One in four is successful. But putting that aside, they don't consider the fact that maybe decertification attempts are unsuccessful because people want to keep the union. That's not addressed at all. But then they
I'm not sure people know what decertification is.
Oh, please, go ahead.
It's not a surgical procedure. It's a way for companies to get rid of unions. And what companies do is they pay a campaign consultant to come into the workplace and to engage in propaganda, terrorism, and coercion to convince workers that it's time for a vote to get rid of the union. And they're allowed, under the current laws, to pay these political consultants who operate in a workplace and are brought in and stationed and work full-time to wage a campaign to get rid of the union. And the laws and the rules currently allow companies to do this. In most countries in the world, this is prohibited. The idea that a company would stick their nose in this kind of business and try and tell workers that they need to get rid of their union is outlawed in most countries. But here it's perfectly legal, and the politicians in Washington who get so much of their money from the big business and Wall Street crowd are happy to step on the toes of average workers and working families and see that unions are exterminated. So that's what decertification means. It means getting rid of a union with a company finance campaign.
Well, granted that context then, I mean, their data that only one in four decertification attempts works, it speaks even better for the union because even in the face of all that, the workers want their unions. And
that's right. You're right. Three out of four times, workers are smart enough to figure out that they're being lied to and being sold a bill of goods. But these folks are clever. They're slick. They don't hesitate to lie. They close the door and laugh at the workers. You know, can you believe what we just told that person? And they believed it. You know, there are confessions from people that do this for a living. They're kind of down there with snake oil salesmen and folks that steal money out of blind men's cups. But people who do this for a living are so disparaging of workers and are so filled with contempt that they do this for a living and make a lot of money doing it because big business is only too happy to pay huge salaries to consultants that come in here to try and destroy unions in a workplace.
Craig Merrilees, that's bringing us to the end of our time together, and I'm kind of glad we don't get to address the very last point because their last point would criminalize union threats and violence, even though they concede later on it's not a problem widespread. So we're not even going to dignify that one with an answer. Craig Merrilees.
Yeah, I'd say let's work on white-collar crime for a change. How about that?
Good man. Craig, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Angie, for your show. Love it. Bye-bye.
Craig Merrilees, Communications Director with the ILWU. I'm Angie Corvo. This is In Deep. Great note to end on. It's a wrap for this week. Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting. Engineer is Matt Fidler. Assistant producer is Cindy Myers. Jill Fidler runs everything else around here. Our incredible interns are Forrest Phillips, Kristen Stevens, Cecilia Castelli, and Megan Nana. Our theme is by Big Troubles. Closing theme by David Gans. Visit our site for web extras from Gotta Laugh and more. We'll see you next week. Thanks for being here. I'm Angie Corriveau.
Before it gets better, it's going to get worse. Before it gets better, but I know it's gonna get better. Yes, I know it's gonna get better, 'cause it almost always does. I can't say much about the who and how, but I believe it just because. Day by day, our bonds unweave. Mammon gloats as nature grieves. Oh, save us from these pious.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep with Angie Corriveau, a production of Talkback Studios. You can get more information about us at indeepradio.com. And while you're there, you can become a member and support our work. There's a link there to contact us, too, with any questions or feedback. We're developing a series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and we'd love to have you be part of that. Please send us your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions through our website. Click the contact button at indeepradio.com. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Corriveau. We'll see you then. We'll You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.